Hello, and welcome to Enabled, a weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. It's designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, and this week I am practicing proper social distancing and talking with you from my home. So thank you for joining me in my dining room. Hey, have you heard? Summer is coming. What do you think of when I mention summer fun? Let me guess, swimming, baseball, and maybe even sailing. Well, there you have it. Today's program will tell you about how people with vision problems can and do have fun with those three summer sports. The first article is about competitive swimming, though not just paddling around in the old swimming hole. The article comes from a website called paralympic.org. How do visually impaired swimmers know where their opponents are is the headline. With raging adrenaline and muscles propelling their bodies at high speed toward a wall, visually impaired swimmers need to know exactly when to turn. Otherwise, they would collide with the wall. That is where swimmer's tapper comes into play. A tapper, that's spelled T-A-P-P-E-R, a tapper is a person who lets the swimmer know when they are approaching the end of the pool by tapping them either once or twice. Timing, the swimmer's preference, and repetition are all important, as five-time U.S. Paralympic champion Brad Snyder and his tapper Brian Leffler explain the tricks and techniques to visually impaired swimming. The first question that's asked is directed to Brad Snyder, the swimmer. How do you manage to swim in a straight line? Brad answers, practice, practice, and more practice. And even then, I still veer off course. That being said, the ways I attempt to stay straight are by always training with symmetry in mind, both in and out of the water. I try to train so that my body is strong on both sides, and I'm employing both sides equally. Even still, I notice differences in strength from one side to the other. So I note these differences and compete with that awareness. I have modified my arm recovery, dragging my fingers along the surface of the water so that if I veer off course toward the lane line, I will hopefully detect the lane line with my fingers, allowing me to correct course before I crash and lose precious time. The next question, how do you know where your opponents are? Brad answers, I don't. That's the magic of blind swimming. We are not really racing each other so much as we are racing ourselves. The third question is, how do you know if you are first, second, or third? Or does that matter? Brad answers, I don't. I often imagine that I'm behind so that it's easier to dig down deep toward the end of the race. The next question, number four, when a tapper taps your head, what does that tell you? How do you know when to turn for another lap? And Brad Snyder, the swimmer, says, well, the tapper taps my back, not my head. When I get the tap, I immediately turn. We feel as though this eliminates any potential errors in stroke counting or whatever else. I try to simplify things as much as possible. So our strategy is tap and then turn, nothing else. The fifth question, have you been a tapper before you worked with Brad? What are some differences among athletes and their tapping preferences? This question is directed toward Brian Leffler, who is the tapper. He says, before, I coached Philip Schultz, who was the 2008 Paralympian. That's where I had my first experience, and I really learned how to tap. There's no official tapping device. It's not a standard piece of equipment. It's a really homemade device. Some people use long fishing poles. Brad would tend to use a cane that we could fold up to transport easily, and it usually has a tennis ball at the end. What also varies for each person is that some people like to be struck on the head, and some people like to be struck on the back. Brad likes the back. Philip liked the head. The next question, number six, is what is the key between tapper and the swimmer? First, this question is directed toward the swimmer, Brad, and he says, the key for me is consistency. It helps the tapper to know my race strategy and what pace I'll be coming into the wall. It helps me if the tapper taps at the same point every time. When we get on the same page, the turn should look exactly like an able-bodied swimmer's turn. You shouldn't even be able to tell that I'm blind. Then the question is directed to Brian Loeffler, who is the tapper. What is the key between a tapper and the swimmer? Brian says, I think it's really important to have a tapper that you trust, because you're swimming at a fast rate into a wall, and you have to know that your tapper is going to tap you, and at a point where you're not too far away or too close to the wall. Some other folks like a long tapping device, like 14 feet long, so they get to tap further out and take a couple of strokes before they flip in. Brad's preference is to be closer so that it's more immediate and he knows when to flip. The next question, what else is important for a tapper on the pool deck? Brian, the tapper, says, you just have to focus on your swimmer. Don't get distracted with what's going on in the race, where they are in the race, or where their competitors are. Don't look at the stands. Your sole job is to focus on them and gauge their speed. It's very much like a relay takeoff. You have to anticipate how fast they're moving and when the point is when they want to receive the tap. I think some other things tappers might be afraid of when they're starting out is being too timid. The swimmer needs to be struck fairly hard. They would rather be struck hard and to feel the tap rather than to question, oh, was that the tap or was that a bump on the landline? Tappers also can't communicate with the swimmers. No words of encouragement or strategy are allowed. The last question, what other facts should we know about how visually impaired swimmers swim? Brad Snyder, the swimmer, says, the most interesting dynamic to me is that after the race, we don't find out the outcome for quite a while because we can't see the scoreboard. It's excruciating to sit in the pool, listening to everyone cheer, hoping it's for you, but not being sure. Next, we'll move on to baseball. This information comes from the Major League Baseball site, MLB.com. The headline reads, Competition, Joy, and a Little Pain. Beep Baseball is a world of freedom for blind athletes. The article was written by Eric Chesterton, and the date was September 19, 2019. That was last fall. As the packed train from Brooklyn at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning suggested, Long Island is a popular place during the summer. The smell of sunscreen dominated the air, perfect for a long day out in the sun on the beach at the Hamptons. So when I got off at an inland station, no one followed me. When my ride pulled up to Senator Spenno Memorial Park in East Meadow, New York, there was nothing about the scene that suggested an event of any importance. Spenno Park is indistinguishable from any other suburban athletic complex designed to host youth soccer games from sunrise to sunset every weekend. There wasn't a sign on the road announcing what was taking place, and the parking lot wasn't even full. Yet, for an entire Saturday in late June, this nondescript park, tucked in the middle of a suburban neighborhood, was host to the Beast of the East Beep Baseball Tournament. It featured five teams stretching from Philadelphia to Boston, some of whom would contend for the Beep Baseball World Series the following month. Beep Baseball is one of the few spaces where the blind people can engage in competition and be a little reckless. Often it's also one of the few places where they can form meaningful social bonds in a world that otherwise prove incredibly isolating. In other words, it's a sport that truly improves lives. But that's all secondary. No one showed up on a hot Saturday for a feel-good story or because they felt their lives needed some enriching. They showed up to win some Beep Baseball games. While the game looks a lot like baseball on the surface, what it looks like is kind of beside the point. Beep Baseball, and that's B-E-E-P, Beep Baseball is a sport for people who are visually impaired. So yes, there's a pitcher, a batter, and fielders. Hitters run to a base after hitting the ball. But there are significant differences from baseball, starting with the equipment and the field they play on. The sport is named after the ball itself. It's a softball-sized ball modified to include a buzzer that beeps at a high pitch 3 times a second. The pitcher, the catcher, and the hitter are all on the same team, working together toward the goal of getting the hitter to hit the ball. The pitcher, who is sighted, stands 20 feet away from home plate and throws to a spot in the batter's swing path. After letting him know that the pitch is coming, he'll say, "Set, ready, ball!" And the batter gets 4 swinging strikes in 1 take. To hit the ball in play, the batter must put it between the first and third baselines, like in baseball, but it also must travel past the 40-foot mark. Once a player hits a ball fair, 2 things occur at once. An umpire flicks a switch in a random direction to activate buzzing in either the first or the third base. Now, these bases are 4 feet tall. They are foam pylons, and each base is located 100 feet from home plate. So once the umpire flicks that switch, this indicates which direction the batter has to run in. Meanwhile, a sighted spotter in the field shouts out a number indicating the zone of the field to which the ball was hit. The 6 fielders then use that information and the beeping of the ball itself in an attempt to hunt it down, a process that involves a lot of diving and communication to avoid collisions. If they can secure the ball before the runner touches the base, it's an out. If the runner reaches the base first, it's a run. Beep baseball isn't the only sport for the blind, and most players are multi-sport athletes. A sport called goal ball, think if you can of a cross between bowling and soccer, goal ball came across as the most popular other sport among the beep baseball players. But there's something about beep that's different from the other sports for the blind. Every sport has a behind-the-scenes debate over how much injury or safety risk is tolerable on the field. In sighted sports, the default is that players should be given the freedom to play. Sports are inherently injury risk. A safety measure, such as a requirement for a helmet or the implantation of a rule to protect the athletes, should be imposed only when the danger of injury is too great. In baseball, for example, rules for sliding into home and second base were only imposed in recent years after lack of regulation resulted in serious injury. For better or worse, the default stance was to let the players play until that proves untenable. Sports for the blind have long approached that debate from the assumption that safety, rather than competition, fun, or challenging oneself, safety should be the guiding principle. One such sport, however, is unique. The story of beep baseball, perhaps not so surprising given its name, begins with the invention of the ball. In 1964, a man named Charlie Fairbanks, an engineer for the Mountain Bell Telephone Company, heard that the Colorado School for the Deaf and Blind was in need of a ball that would work for their students to play sports. They already had a football with bells attached to it, but once the ball stopped moving, it became impossible to locate. It didn't make for a particularly fun game. So after experimenting with various balls, Fairbanks decided softballs would be the best carrier for his beeping device. This device was a combination of spare telephone parts that he had found lying around his home workshop. He would deconstruct softballs, insert his jury-rigged beeper, and then hand them off to his wife, whose name was Vi, and she would stitch them back up. The first version of beep baseball popped up a few years later. In 1971, someone named Ralph Rock from the San Francisco Telephone Pioneers created a new game using Fairbanks' beeping ball. However, safety was at the center of the game in a way that sapped the fun out of it. Sort of like being at your local swimming pool and you couldn't run, it was illegal. Batters had to walk to the base. If you ran, you were out. Likewise, fielders had to walk in pursuit of the ball. A fielder caught running would result in the batting team getting an automatic run. In short, trying hard was against the rules. Obviously, Rock's goal wasn't to create a sport. What kind of game outlaws running? And he said as much. He said, "We're not trying to create a new sport," he said to the Associated Press in 1973. "This is therapy. We're trying to break through the frustrations and give kids a sense of accomplishment." Well, unsurprisingly, that game never really caught on. What's the point of sports? Sure, they provide entertainment for spectators and fans, but that's more a happy accident than the actual point. Sports are about the people who play them. They are about athletes accepting a challenge, dedicating an almost troubling amount of time and energy to it, taking risks along the way. And after all that, achieving something that no one thought possible. It didn't take long for players to create a more enjoyable game. A man named John Ross was frustrated by the lack of challenge available in this version of Beef Baseball. He was a publisher of Braille sports newspaper called Feeling Sports. His name was John Ross, and he was given a version of Fairbanks Ball, and he began to develop a new game, one that removed many of Rock's kid gloves. The Minnesota Rules Ross, that was his nickname, Minnesota Rules, came up with a sport with a very similar look to the current game. Most importantly, the game was fun. Sure, fielders would occasionally bust their knees diving for balls or get shaken up, colliding with each other in the field, but the players liked it. Ted Fass is the director of the Long Island Bombers, but he no longer plays for the team. But when he did play, he earned the nickname of Crash for his reckless style of play that would surely have been out of place in Ralph Rock's game. But the same trait that earned him that nickname, Crash, also earned him an early retirement. Like so many former baseball players, Fass's knees no longer allow him to play beep. But you don't hear regret in his voice when he talks about that. Being able to play that way is what drew him and so many others to the game in the first place. It stretches the imagination to conjure an image of a uniquely aggressive or reckless beep player. Unlike baseball, beep is very much a contact sport. Scoring a run involves slamming into a pylon and often falling to the ground along with it. Fielding involves literally blindly diving after the ball. Within minutes of watching my first beep baseball game, I saw two players collide in the field, pursuing the ball at full speed. It was definitely not the last collision that took place that day. I would feel comfortable attaching the name Crash to anyone on that field. Watching Fass must have been wild. Before beep, many of the players had a much more sheltered experience of their lives, as if Ralph Rock designed every aspect to avoid risk in their lives. In many activities, they are accompanied by aides or sighted guides. A man named Sherlock Washington was at the tournament with the New Jersey Lightning, but it seems he's played with almost every team there is. He also plays numerous other sports for the blind. He said, "This is a joy to be outdoors." Washington said, "It's a joy to be running free without having to have a sighted guide." With that freedom comes collisions and injuries. But ask any player about those risks and you'll get a shrug. It's part of the game. I talked to Jim Hughes from the Long Island Bombers just minutes after he was involved in a collision on the field. While he hopes to avoid the next one, he isn't bothered by it at all. And here's a quote from someone else. "It's just like being active, and it's just being able to run freely," said Alfonso Harrell of the New Jersey Titans. And this is what he said in regard to making beep baseball so special to him. He says, "I'm not able to do that in my everyday life." But he's also attracted to the team aspect of the game. And he says, "Knowing that I'm helping other people win a game, I can't get that doing anything else." Unlike most other sporting events, there's not constant cheering and chatter to let you know that the fans and the players are into it. Encouragement and taunting from the dugout is lacking. Well, that's not because players aren't enjoying themselves, and it's not because they don't have their teammates' backs. It's just part of the nature of the sport. The object of the game is to track down beeping objects, whether it's the batter running toward the base or the fielders hunting for the ball. You can't do that if there's a lot of ambient noise. And that's why play comes to a complete halt if an airplane flies over the field. and why no one cheers until each play comes to an end. But when the play ends, whether it results in a run or an out, teammates rush to the player who got the run or recorded the out for congratulations. At the tournament Beast of the East, the Titans won the day in terms of team spirit. They had coordinated cheers after seemingly every play. The social aspect for every team is hard to undersell. FAS described BEEP as a social environment for players that have very little social background. But hanging out behind the dugout, you'd never get that impression. It sounds like any other close-knit group that you've ever been around. They have nicknames for each other, they cheer each other on, they talk trash. Hughes, who wrestled throughout high school, described BEEP as the most rewarding of the blind sports. He says it's legitimate competition for blind people. We're hitting a pitched ball, which is incredible. I can remember the first time I hit a live pitch. I'm like, this is frickin' awesome. You want to be in that situation where you're competing, Hughes continued. It's not taken away from you just because you have a particular disability. You just have to find new outlets and adaptive manners to engage yourself. So in a lot of ways, BEEP baseball isn't much different than any other sport. From the level of skill required to play it well, to the potential of participants to discover themselves in it. For the players, the game offers an opportunity to run free for a while in a world created for the visually impaired. So, on a sweltering Saturday in June, they showed up at a park on Long Island to play BEEP baseball for an entire day. It didn't matter that no one was watching, because the field is where they can set their disability aside. They're not there as some kind of a feel-good story. They are there to win by diving for the ball and hustling down the line. If they pick up a couple of bruises along the way, well, that's just part of being an athlete. This article was written by Eric Chesterton. He's a writer for MLB.com. He is an appreciator of the stolen base, the bunt against the shift, and nearly every unconventional uniform design. He is eagerly awaiting Jamie Moyer's inevitable comeback. So now we'll switch to the final sport of summer, sailing. This information comes from the website www.carroll.org. That Carroll is spelled C-A-R-R-O-L-L. This is referring to the Carroll Center for the Blind, which was established in 1936. It's a vision rehabilitation center in Newton, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. You could call it the CCB, the Carroll Center for the Blind. The article headline reads, Feel the Wind, Come Sail Away. Sail Blind, the name of the program. Sail Blind provides blind and visually impaired people with an opportunity to learn the art and science of sailing. Blind adults and children can learn to sail through the adaptive methods developed by the Carroll Center Sail Blind Program and through the abilities of sighted sailors who volunteer as sailing guides. No sailing experience is necessary for the blind sailors to participate, but the sighted guides must meet specific criteria. Sailing lessons are conducted weekly for recreational sailors out of the facilities of the Courageous Sailing Center in Charlestown, Massachusetts. They do their sailing in Boston Harbor. Recreational sailing meets every Saturday throughout the summer. Safety is paramount concern in sailing, and all the participants, blind and sighted, must wear life jackets while in the boat and on the dock. The cost? Blind sailors are charged a nominal fee to participate. Sighted guides sail for free while sharing their time and expertise with the blind sailors. Registration is required. Here's some contact information for you. The email would be sailblind, it's all one word, sailblind@carroll.org. You can call them at 617-242-3821. The sighted guide sailors. Experienced sighted sailors are always needed as guides. The sighted guide sailors must be experienced on the type of boat that's being used under the existing conditions. They must be approved by the sail blind director. New guides will be shown methods for guiding the blind sailors and must demonstrate adequate sailing skills for either racing or recreational sailing. Those are two of the programs they run there. The sailing options, and there are two, as I just mentioned. The first one we were talking about, recreational sailing is available to blind persons at all levels of ability. It's provided every Saturday from June through August from 10:30 to 1:30 to those who are properly registered. I'll be giving you that registration information again. The cost to participate, $5 per person per week. The boats used are the Rhodes 19. These are safe, easy to use keel boats. They carry 3 to 4 people comfortably. Family and guests may join the blind sailor provided there is ample room for all the registered blind sailors. Novice blind sailors are introduced to safety considerations, what to wear, the layout and the parts of the boat, the principles of sailing, and hands-on techniques for steering and trimming the sails. The experienced blind sailors can improve their sailing skills through instruction and practice throughout the summer. Another one of their programs is called Blind Sailing International. This program brings blind sailors from throughout the world together to race competitively and to promote the value and benefits of blind sailing. Since 1992, blind sailing world championships have been conducted in different locations throughout the world, including New Zealand, Australia, England, Italy, and in the USA, in Florida, and in Rhode Island. Blind Sailing International was formalized in 1994, and the Carroll Center Sail Blind Program is one of the founding member organizations. And they actually house the executive office for the Blind Sailing International. From 1999 to 2009, currently the BSI is headquartered in Auckland, New Zealand. If you're interested in finding out more about that, again, the website is carroll.org, and remember that's spelled carroll.org. Their email address is sailblind@carroll.org, or the phone number, area code 617-242-3821. Well, recapping today's program, you heard how a tapper is the key to success for a competitive swimmer who is blind. You also heard about the robust sport of beach baseball and the much more placid experience of sailing in Boston Harbor. To end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Sports do not build character, they reveal it. This was said by Haywood Brown, a memorable American journalist. He worked as a sports writer, newspaper columnist, and editor in New York City in the early 1900s. He was founder of the American Newspaper Guild. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled on WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates, information, and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, reachoutradio.org.